Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're dissecting a topic that, well, it touches everyone, yet few truly understand it. The intricacies of arrest, search, and seizure, along with related offenses.
That's right.
We're going to unravel the precise legal definitions, reveal some surprising nuances, and explore how these concepts actually play out in real-world scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
This deep dive is designed as a comprehensive, detailed explanation for anyone maybe new to these critical legal concepts. Think of it as your shortcut to truly understanding your rights and, you know, the responsibilities of law enforcement.
Indeed. And our source material for this deep dive, it gives us an invaluable, really detailed look at the fundamental principles taught to peace officers themselves. It's drawn from an actual police department training handout.
Oh, interesting. So straight from the source.
Exactly. Our mission here is to demystify these complex legal terms, understand the conditions that define a lawful arrest, and examine the various offenses that can pop up in interactions with law enforcement.
Okay, so let's dive right in. When we talk about arrest, what does that actually mean in the eyes of the law? Because, like you said, it feels like it's far more precise than just someone shouting, "You're under arrest."
It absolutely is. Yeah, it's not just a single moment. It's really a combination of very specific conditions that that must be met for an arrest to be legally sound.
Okay.
And the law outlines four necessary conditions for an arrest to be, you know, legally complete.
Four conditions, right.
The first of these is intent. This is all about the officer's purpose, their state of mind.
Intent. Okay.
An arrest isn't some casual conversation or just a sudden unplanned reaction. It begins with the officer having a clear, articulated purpose, a deliberate objective to take a person into the custody of the law.
So they have to mean to arrest someone.
Precisely. They must genuinely intend to deprive someone of their liberty and bring them under legal control. And that's a significant, serious step with real legal ramifications.
Okay. So it starts with the officer's conscious decision. Makes sense. What comes after that initial intent?
Following intent, we have authority. An officer's arrest must be made under what's termed real authority.
Real authority.
Yeah, and this means two crucial things. First, the officer has to be legally authorized by law to make that arrest. They can't just be, you know, acting on a whim or some personal grievance.
Right.
And second, and this is critical, that arrest has to be supported by probable cause.
Probable cause. We hear that term a lot. What does it mean right here?
Well, it's not just a hunch or like a gut feeling. Probable cause in this context means a reasonable belief based on specific and articulable facts.
Specific facts.
That a crime has been committed, is being committed, or is about to be committed by the person they intend to arrest. It's really the bedrock upon which most arrests are built, ensuring there's a certain level of factual justification before someone's liberty gets curtailed.
Okay, so you've got the intent, the officer has the legal authority, and it's backed by probable cause. What does that look like, you know, physically, the actual act?
Right. That's where actual seizure comes in. This is the physical manifestation of the arrest. It's when the person is literally taken into custody.
Okay.
Now, this can happen in one of two ways, either through physical force, like, you know, an officer actually putting handcuffs on someone.
The obvious one.
The obvious one, yes. Or by the person's submission to the officer's assertion of authority.
Submission. How does that work?
An example of submission would be someone complying with an order, like stop, put your hands behind your back, even if the officer hasn't touched them yet. Their freedom of movement is physically restrained, or they voluntarily yielded to the officer's command. It's that moment their liberty is undeniably controlled by law enforcement.
Got it. And the final piece of this this legal puzzle, you mentioned four conditions. What's the last one? It seemed really important.
Yes. Understanding. This is incredibly important. The person being arrested must have a clear understanding of the officer's intention to arrest them.
So they have to know they're being arrested.
Exactly. Now, this isn't about whether they agree with the arrest or think it's fair or justified.
Right.
But whether they comprehend that they are, in fact, being arrested and ideally why. This understanding is vital, not just for the legality of the arrest itself, but also for how an individual might react.
How so?
Well, think about it. If someone genuinely doesn't understand they're being arrested, maybe they think they're just being stopped for questioning. Their subsequent actions, like trying to walk away, might be interpreted differently than if they fully comprehended the situation and then chose to, say, resist. So these four conditions, intent, authority, actual seizure, and understanding, they have to coalesce, they have to come together for a legally complete arrest.
It's not just one thing, it's all four.
Exactly. It's their combination that solidifies the legal status of an individual in the eyes of the law.
So we have these four conditions for an arrest. But you hear other terms thrown around, legal language like restraint or custody. They sound similar, maybe, but I gather they have distinct meanings. How do they fit in?
Absolutely. They do have distinct meanings, and understanding them is crucial for getting the full picture of interactions with law enforcement. Let's start with restraint.
Okay.
As defined in the Code of Criminal Procedure, CCP 11.22, this term means a control one person exercises over another, primarily to subject them to authority and power.
Control. Okay.
But crucially, it does not necessarily mean confining them within specific limits, like in a room or a car.
So it's broader than being physically confined.
Much broader. Think of it like this. An officer might order you to stay put, stop right there, and you comply. In that moment, you are under restraint because you're subjected to their authority and power, even if you're not handcuffed or in a small
Right,
space.
because you can't just walk away.
Exactly. It's about that general control, that moment where you feel you're no longer free to simply leave, but you're subject to another's command.
Okay, that clarifies restraint. Building on that, when is someone officially arrested according to CCP 15.22?
A person is legally considered arrested when they have been actually placed under restraint, that control we just talked about, or taken into custody.
Yeah.
And this can be by an officer or, interestingly, any other person, whether they have a warrant or not. Now, this highlights that while officers typically make arrests, the legal definition allows for an arrest by any person or officer as long as those four conditions we discussed earlier are met.
So that initial restraint, that marks the arrest.
That initial moment of restraint or taking into custody, even if it's not yet full physical confinement, that marks the point of arrest legally.
Then there's custody. That's CCP 38.01. This one sounds, I don't know, more formal.
It generally is. Custody means a person is either one, under arrest by a peace officer,
Okay.
or two, under restraint by a public servant because of a court order.
Like a judge's order.
Exactly. Or three, under restraint by an agent or employee of a government facility that confines people for criminal offenses, like a jail or prison.
Yeah.
So while restraint can be that broad assertion of control, custody usually signifies being formally held either as part of an arrest by court order or within a designated confinement facility. It denotes a more established governmental control over someone's liberty.
This is fascinating. And you mentioned the law even defines custody beyond just physical touch, which led us to constructive custody under CCP 11.21. Can you break that down? That sounds subtle.
It is subtle, but really important. Constructive custody basically expands the definition beyond just physical detention. It includes any coercive measures by threats, menaces, or the fear of injury, where one person controls another and detains them within certain limits.
Coercive measures, like threats.
Exactly. Imagine a scenario. Maybe an officer is standing in your doorway. They're not touching you, but they're positioned in a way or saying things that make you feel like you absolutely cannot leave. Or maybe they make a statement that implies, bad things will happen if you don't comply. Even without physical force, if a person feels detained due to those implied threats or just the sheer assertion of authority, that can be constructive custody.
Wow. So it's about the feeling of being controlled, not just being physically held.
Precisely. It's about the perception of being controlled. It's a subtle but pretty powerful concept in how the law views limitations on a person's freedom.
So, okay, with all these definitions, arrest, restraint, custody, constructive custody, what does this mean for the exact moment an arrest is considered completed? Especially when you compare it to just being, say, detained for questioning. There feels like a fine line there.
There is a fine line, and it's a very important nuance. This is where the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution really comes into play. A Fourth Amendment seizure of a person happens the moment you're told you're under arrest or even just detained, implying your freedom of movement is restricted.
So the moment they say stop or you're detained.
Pretty much. At that moment, your liberty is considered curtailed under the Fourth Amendment. However, the arrest itself, from a purely legal standpoint, might not be considered fully completed until that actual physical restraint or custody has happened, or a constructive custody situation has been established.
Okay, why does that distinction matter so much?
It's crucial because upon the announcement of detention or arrest, that Fourth Amendment seizure, even before physical restraint, the individual is generally considered subjected to the officer's authority.
Ah.
And this means that at that point, certain offenses, things like resisting arrest or evading detention, can be triggered if the person doesn't comply.
So just hearing you're detained changes your legal obligations immediately.
In essence, yes. It's kind of a legal tripwire, if you will. The individual's responsibilities shift the moment their freedom is restricted by that assertion of authority. Understanding these precise definitions, arrest, restraint, custody, it's absolutely fundamental because they form the basis for so many related offenses that people might maybe inadvertently commit during interactions with law enforcement.
Right. Knowing these distinctions could literally change the entire course of an encounter, taking it from just a conversation to potentially a criminal charge very quickly.
Exactly. It can happen in moments.
Let's dive into some of those specific offenses then, starting with resisting arrest, search, or transportation. That's CCP 38.03. What does this one involve, and is there a common misconception about it?
Okay, resisting arrest. This offense occurs when a person intentionally prevents or obstructs someone they know is a peace officer or someone acting under their direction, like maybe a security guard helping out, from carrying out an arrest, a search, or transporting them.
Intentionally obstructs. Okay.
And the absolute key here is the use of force against the officer or another person. It's not just disagreeing or arguing. It requires force.
Force, like physical force.
Yes, physical force. For example, let's say an officer is trying to place someone under arrest for maybe driving while intoxicated, DWI. If that suspect starts, say, kicking at the officer or trying to physically pull away while being placed in the patrol car, or even kicks the patrol vehicle itself,
right,
that act of using force against the officer's attempt to arrest or transport them would likely fall under resisting. It's a very direct application of force trying to stop the officer's actions.
Okay, and here's the part that I think surprises a lot of people. The source material mentions that it's explicitly not a defense that the arrest itself was unlawful. Can you talk about that? That seems counterintuitive.
It does seem counterintuitive, but it's a critical legal principle, really designed to prevent violence on the streets and maintain order during potentially volatile situations.
Yeah.
The law, CCP 38.03, specifically states that it is NO defense to prosecution under this section that the arrest or search was unlawful.
Wow.
So what this means is, even if you firmly believe right there in that moment that the officer is acting without a legal basis, without probable cause, whatever, you cannot legally use force to resist that arrest or search.
So you can't fight back physically, even if you think they're wrong.
Correct. The fundamental reasoning behind this is that the proper place to challenge the legality of an arrest or search is in court, through your lawyer, through the legal system.
Not on the side of the road.
Exactly. Not through a physical confrontation at the point of contact. The law wants to de-escalate potential violence in the field. So the penalties for resisting reflect this. It's typically a Class A misdemeanor, which is serious. It can carry significant jail time and fines.
And it can get worse.
Oh, yes. It escalates to a third-degree felony if the individual uses a deadly weapon while resisting. The law takes any use of force against an officer very seriously, especially if a weapon is involved.
Okay, so resisting involves force. What if someone tries to run away or walk away quickly? That brings us to a different offense, right? Evading arrest or detention, CCP 38.04. How is that different?
Right. The key distinction with evading is fleeing. It's about flight. This offense involves a person intentionally fleeing from someone they know is a peace officer or maybe a federal special investigator who is attempting lawfully to arrest or detain them.
Okay, attempting lawfully. That sounds like a key difference from resisting.
It is. Notice that crucial difference. For evading, the officer must be attempting a lawful arrest or detention. Whereas for resisting, remember, the law specifically says the unlawfulness of the arrest is no defense if you use force.
Got it. So for evading, the initial stop or detention attempt needs to be legal.
Generally, yes. So let's take an example. An officer, maybe in full uniform, smells marijuana coming from someone smoking a hand-rolled cigarette. The officer reasonably suspects illegal activity and orders the person to stop for investigation. If that suspect looks at the officer, understands they're being told to stop, and then just bolts and runs.
That's evading.
That's likely evading. The officer's attempt to detain, based on the smell of marijuana, would probably be considered lawful, reasonable suspicion. The core idea here isn't just about the act of running. It's that fleeing from an officer, especially if you use a vehicle, has consequences that can spiral really, really quickly. It often turns a potentially minor issue into a serious felony.
Yeah, I imagine the penalties reflect that escalation. How serious can evading get?
They vary significantly, which is important for people to understand. The standard penalty for just evading on foot, let's say, is a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, same baseline as resisting.
Right, but it escalates fast. It becomes a state jail felony if the person has a previous conviction for evading. So repeat offenders face tougher consequences.
Makes sense.
And then it jumps to a third-degree felony if the actor uses a vehicle while fleeing.
The car chase scenario.
Exactly. Or also a third-degree felony if another person suffers serious bodily injury as a direct result of the police trying to catch them during the flight. Or if the actor uses a tire deflation device like caltrops, or if the evading happens while smuggling a person.
So hurting someone indirectly during the chase bumps it up significantly.
It does. And the most severe is a second-degree felony. That happens if another person suffers death or serious bodily injury because the actor used a tire deflation device, again, as a direct result of the officer's attempt to apprehend them.
Wow. Serious consequences.
Very serious. And it's also important to remember this offense can be prosecuted in addition to other laws. It's often called stackable. So you can be charged with the original reason for the stop plus evading arrest.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've covered resisting with force and evading by fleeing. What about helping someone else avoid the police? That sounds like hindering apprehension or prosecution under CCP 38.05.
Precisely. This offense comes into play when a person with the specific intent to hinder the arrest, prosecution, conviction, or punishment of another person, or even a child involved in delinquent conduct, takes certain actions.
What kind of actions?
Things like harboring or concealing the person they know police are looking for, or providing them with weapons, transportation, or disguise. Basically, any means of avoiding arrest or effecting an escape, or simply warning them that the police are coming or about to discover them.
Okay, so like shouting a warning.
Exactly. For instance, if an officer approaches a house looking for, let's say, Joe, who has a warrant, someone comes to the door, sees the officer, and yells and said, "Run, Joe, it's the police, they're here for you." And then Joe darts out the back door.
Got it.
In that scenario, the person who yelled the warning is likely hindering apprehension, and Joe, by running, is likely evading.
Is there any defense to that? Like, what if you were just trying to get them to turn themselves in?
Yes, there is a key defense. It's a defense to prosecution. If the warning was given specifically with the intent to bring the other person into compliance with the law, like, hey, the police are here, you should go talk to them, that's different.
Okay. And the penalties for hindering?
Generally, it's a Class A misdemeanor. But similar to other offenses, it becomes more serious, a third-degree felony, if the person being harbored, concealed, or warned is already under arrest for, charged with, or convicted of a felony, or involved in felony-level delinquent conduct, and the person helping them knew about that felony status.
So helping a known felon escape carries a much heavier penalty.
Absolutely. The severity increases dramatically when a serious crime is involved.
Okay, let's look at something a bit broader now. Interference with public duties, which is CCP 38.15. This one seems like it could cover a whole range of actions, maybe not even directly confrontational.
It does. It's a very broad offense. It applies when a person acting with criminal negligence, meaning they should have been aware of the risk their actions created, interrupts, disrupts, impedes, or otherwise interferes with various public servants while they're performing their official duties.
And who counts as a public servant here? Just police?
No, it's quite broad. It includes the obvious ones like peace officers and firefighters, but it also covers emergency medical services personnel like paramedics, animal control officers, even public health or environmental officials doing inspections. It also includes interfering with police animals like a canine unit if you know it's a police animal. And interestingly, it even covers interfering with emergency communications on a citizen's band radio.
Wow. Okay. And the penalty?
The standard penalty for this is a Class B misdemeanor.
So it's not just about direct physical interference then. What about arguing or yelling? What are the key defenses here, especially regarding speech? Because that sounds like it could potentially clash with free speech rights.
That's a crucial point, and the law addresses it. There are two key defenses written into the statute. First, it's a defense if the conduct was intended solely to warn someone operating a motor vehicle of an officer's presence who was just enforcing traffic laws like flashing your headlights to warn about a speed trap, for example.
Okay, the classic warning.
Right. But more importantly, and this gets discussed a lot, it is a defense if the interruption, disruption, impediment, or interference alleged consisted of speech only.
Speech only. What does that mean in practice?
It generally means that merely speaking, even if you're being critical, unhelpful, maybe even yelling at an officer or firefighter, may not rise to the level of criminal interference under this statute as long as it's only speech. It's meant to safeguard legitimate free speech rights during interactions.
But where's the line? When does speech cross over into interference?
That's where it gets tricky. It often depends on the context and whether the speech is combined with actions or creates an immediate safety risk. For instance, let's revisit a scenario. A suspect, maybe during what started as a consensual encounter, suddenly takes a bladed stance, raises their hands aggressively, and yells, "Don't come near me," when an officer expresses concern for safety and wants to conduct a frisk.
Huh.
That combination of the verbal refusal, "Don't come near me," plus the aggressive physical posturing could potentially be interpreted as interference, arguably moving beyond speech only because it involves threatening physical action.
Right. It's words plus action.
Exactly. Compare that to, say, an intoxicated person at an apartment fire scene who ignores commands from fire personnel, walks over to the fire truck, and starts trying to turn knobs and levers, directly disrupting the firefighting efforts. That's clearly interference involving physical action impeding public duties.
That makes sense. The source also mentioned something about disseminating officer information.
Yes, there's a specific part of the statute that creates a serious rebuttable presumption. If someone intentionally disseminates an officer's or their family member's home address, phone number, emergency contact info, or social security number, it's presumed to be interference with public duties.
Presumed.
Meaning the law assumes it is interference and the burden shifts to the person who disseminated it to prove otherwise. There's an exception for licensed radio TV stations or qualified newspapers. This part really highlights a modern concern for officer safety and privacy, preventing doxing.
Okay, very relevant today. Now let's move to actually breaking free from custody. We have escape under CCP 38.06, and alongside it, the very significant effect of unlawful custody under CCP 38.08. What constitutes escape?
Right. Escape is committed when a person escapes from custody while they are under arrest, lawfully detained, charged with, or convicted of an offense. It also applies if they're in custody because of a lawful court order or detained in a secure detention facility like a juvenile facility or even in the custody of a juvenile probation officer for violating a court order.
So basically breaking free from any form of legal holding.
Pretty much. And the legal meaning of escape itself, defined in CCP 38.01, is basically an unauthorized departure from custody or even just failing to return to custody after a temporary leave, like for a work release program or a furlough.
Yeah, okay.
Importantly, it specifically says it does not include standard parole or probation violations unless those violations involve breaking conditions of confinement in a secure correctional facility.
Got it. And the penalties for escape, I imagine these get serious fast depending on why the person was in custody.
They do, and they escalate quite severely. The baseline offense is a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay.
However, it jumps to a third-degree felony if the person escaping was under arrest for, charged with, or convicted of a felony, or if they were confined in a secure correctional or law enforcement facility, or committed to a secure juvenile facility.
So escaping from jail or after a felony charge is automatically a felony escape.
Correct, and it gets worse. It becomes a second-degree felony if the actor causes bodily injury to someone while escaping.
Like hurting a guard.
Exactly. And the most severe penalty, a first-degree felony, applies if the actor causes serious bodily injury or death, or if they use or even just threaten to use a deadly weapon to make their escape.
Okay, very serious. Now, this brings us back to that crucial point about unlawful custody. What if the person who escapes genuinely believes, or maybe it's later proven, that their initial custody was unlawful? Does that give them a defense?
This is such a fundamental principle of law enforcement and a key takeaway for anyone interacting with the legal system. The answer, according to CCP 38.08, titled Effect of Unlawful Custody, is unequivocally no.
No defense at all.
None. The statute explicitly states that it is no defense to prosecution for escape or for permitting or facilitating escape that the custody was unlawful.
Wow, that's stark.
It is. It really underscores the legal imperative. You must comply with custody, even if you believe it's completely unwarranted. The place to challenge the legality of your detention or arrest is through the proper legal channels, your lawyer, the courts, not by trying to escape.
So the law prioritizes the process over the potential underlying injustice of the custody itself, at least when it comes to the act of escaping.
Exactly. The law prioritizes the orderly function of the justice system. Attempting to escape, even from what might later be determined to be unlawful custody, is considered a separate serious crime in itself.
Okay, that's crystal clear. So, while escape is about the person breaking free themselves, what about people who help them? Is there a specific crime for that?
Yes, that falls under permitting or facilitating escape, which is defined in CCP 38.07. This offense primarily targets those who enable an escape.
Who does it apply to?
It applies first to an official or employee of a correctional facility who knowingly permits or facilitates the escape of someone in their custody. Think a guard looking the other way or providing a key.
Right. Insider help.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it also applies more broadly to any person who knowingly causes or facilitates the escape of someone who's in custody due to an allegation or adjudication of delinquency for juveniles, or someone under involuntary commitment for mental illness or chemical dependency.
Okay, so it covers helping people escape from situations other than just criminal custody.
Correct. The penalties start as a Class A misdemeanor, but they upgrade significantly, similar to escape itself. It becomes a third-degree felony if the person being helped was in custody for a felony or was confined after felony conviction. And it becomes a second-degree felony if either the helper or the escapee used or threatened to use a deadly weapon, or if the person escaping was confined in a secure correctional facility after a felony conviction.
And what if someone provides, like, tools for an escape? A file and a cake, that sort of thing.
The classic scenario. That's covered by Implements for Escape, CCP 38.09. A person commits this offense if, with the specific intent to facilitate escape, they introduce something into a correctional facility or provide it directly to someone in custody or an inmate.
What kind of something?
It could be a deadly weapon, obviously, but the law says, or anything that may be useful for escape. That's very broad.
So literally anything useful, a paperclip?
Potentially, yes. If the intent was to facilitate escape, even something seemingly innocuous could qualify. It covers everything from a simple paperclip that could maybe pick a lock to a makeshift shiv, a rope made of bedsheets, or, of course, an actual firearm.
And the penalties.
It's a third-degree felony just for providing anything useful with intent, but it elevates to a second-degree felony if the item introduced or provided was a deadly weapon. The intent to help someone escape is the absolute key element here.
Okay, moving to another really serious offense involving officers directly. Taking or attempting to take a weapon from an officer or similar professional, that's CCP 38.14. This sounds incredibly dangerous.
It is, absolutely. And the law treats it as such. This offense happens when a person intentionally or knowingly, and this is important with force, takes or even just attempts to take certain items from specific officials.
What items and which officials?
The items listed are a firearm, a nightstick, a stun gun, or a personal protection chemical dispensing device, like pepper spray. And the officials covered include peace officers, federal special investigators, correctional facility employees or officials, parole officers, community supervision officers, probation officers, and even commissioned security officers.
Okay, so a wide range of law enforcement and related personnel. What about knowing they're an officer?
There's a presumption of knowledge built in. The law presumes the actor knew the person's official capacity if the officer was wearing a distinctive uniform or badge, or if they verbally identified themselves as an officer.
Makes sense for officer safety. Is there any situation where trying to take an officer's weapon isn't a crime? Or is there a defense?
Yes, there is a very critical defense outlined in the statute for this extremely serious charge. It is a defense if the defendant took or attempted to take the weapon from an official who was using force against the defendant or against another person in excess of the amount of force permitted by law.
The excessive force situation again.
Exactly. This is a crucial nuance. It acknowledges those rare but potential situations where someone might be legally justified in attempting to disarm an official who is clearly acting unlawfully and using excessive force, posing an immediate threat.
That's a really important exception.
Yeah.
And the penalties if that defense doesn't apply.
They are severe. It's a state jail felony just for attempting to take the weapon with force. And it's a third degree felony for actually succeeding in taking the weapon.
Okay. Now let's shift focus slightly to items inside correctional facilities. Prohibited substances and items in correctional or civil commitment facility, CCP 38.11. This section seems really extensive.
It is indeed. It's quite comprehensive and covers a wide array of items and actions related to bringing contraband into or possessing it within correctional facilities or civil commitment facilities like state hospitals.
What kind of things are prohibited?
Essentially, it criminalizes providing or possessing with intent to provide things like alcoholic beverages, controlled substances, illegal drugs, dangerous drugs, prescription drugs, unless prescribed to that inmate, deadly weapons, cellular phones, or even just their components like SIM cards, money, or even cigarettes and tobacco products, although tobacco might be subject to specific local jail rules.
So bringing almost anything unauthorized in is a problem.
Yes. It covers bringing them into the facility, possessing them on the property, like in the parking lot, or for inmates, possessing these items while confined. It also specifically targets the act of acquiring or making payments for cell phone services with the intent to provide a device for use by someone in custody. They really try to cover all the angles.
That really does cast a wide net. What are the typical penalties, and are there any defenses or exceptions?
Generally, any offense under this section is a third-degree felony.
Wow, a felony just for bringing in cigarettes or a cell phone?
Yes. And even attempting to commit these offenses is also charged as a third-degree felony. It highlights how seriously the law takes maintaining security and control within these facilities.
Okay. Any exceptions?
There are a few specific affirmative defenses. For example, if the possession of a drug was based on a valid prescription for that inmate, or if the delivery was to an authorized place like a warehouse, pharmacy, or a doctor's office located on the facility property.
What about religious reasons?
Yes, there's one for that. A duly authorized clergy member is allowed to take 4 ounces or less of an alcoholic beverage, like sacramental wine, into a correctional facility for a religious ritual, but they have to personally consume it or leave with any unused portion.
Interesting detail. Any others?
And for deadly weapons, it's a defense if the person possessing it is a peace officer or an authorized facility officer or employee who is on duty or traveling directly to or from their assignment.
So, practical example.
Sure. If a visitor at a county jail is seen passing a cell phone to an inmate during visitation that's providing a prohibited item, a third-degree felony, or if another visitor gets frisked upon entry to a local jail and a switchblade knife is found in their pocket that's possessing a deadly weapon in a correctional facility, also likely a third-degree felony. These scenarios show the direct application of this statute.
What if it's an item that's not specifically listed in that big section? Not drugs, alcohol, weapons, or cell phones, like maybe just an extra pair of socks or modified toothbrush. Is that covered?
Yes. That brings us to contraband in correctional facility, CCP 38.114. This section acts as a sort of catch-all for other unauthorized items.
A catch-all? How does it define contraband then?
Contraband here is specifically defined as any item not provided by or authorized by the operator of the correctional facility, or it could be any authorized item that has been altered to accommodate a use other than its original intended use.
Think maybe sharpening a toothbrush handle?
And crucially, the definition explicitly says it does not include any item that is already specifically prohibited under Section 38.11, the one we just discussed, to avoid charging someone twice for the same item under different laws.
Got it. And the penalties for this type of contraband? Less severe than the third-degree felonies?
Generally, yes. It's usually a Class C misdemeanor for most individuals, which is like a traffic ticket, punishable by fine only. However, it's elevated to a Class B misdemeanor if the offense is committed by an employee or a volunteer of the correctional facility.
Why tougher for employees?
It reflects the higher level of trust and responsibility placed on them to maintain the security and rules of the facility.
Makes sense. And finally, there's one more very specific offense related to weapons inside. Deadly weapon in penal institution, CCP 46.0. How is this different from the prohibited items section?
This one is focused specifically on the person confined in the penal institution. It covers an inmate who intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly carries, possesses, or conceals a deadly weapon within that institution.
So it's about the inmate having the weapon, not someone bringing it in.
Exactly. And because of the inherent danger of weapons inside a prison or jail, this is treated with utmost seriousness. The penalty is a third-degree felony.
Any defenses for the inmate?
There is one affirmative defense. If the inmate's conduct, meaning their possession of the weapon, was specifically authorized by an employee of the penal institution, maybe for a work detail, although that would be rare and highly controlled.
Right.
And like many of these, this offense can also be prosecuted in addition to other related laws, making it stackable.
Okay, we have covered a ton of ground conceptually. We've gone from the basic definition of arrest through all these nuances of restraint and custody and explored a whole range of related offenses people might encounter. But what about exceptions to the rule? Are there certain individuals who have special privileges regarding arrest? And once an officer does decide to make an arrest, what are the actual practical on-the-ground procedures they have to follow?
Right, this raises that important question. How do these detailed legal principles translate into practical, hands-on procedures for officers who are often acting in really dynamic, fast-moving situations? And what specific protections exist for certain individuals under very particular circumstances? It's really where the legal theory meets the day-to-day reality of law enforcement work.
Let's start with those exemptions from arrest. It's kind of fascinating that some people actually have a legal privilege against being arrested under certain conditions. Who are they?
They do, but it's under very specific limited conditions. First, we have legislators. Specifically, Texas senators and representatives are privileged from arrest during the legislative session and also while traveling to and from it.
Traveling to and from. How long does that last?
The travel allowance is quite precise, actually. The law gives them 1 day for every 20 miles distance between their home residence and the capital, Austin.
Huh. So if they live 80 miles away,
that would give them 4 days of travel privilege before the session starts and 4 days after it ends. Similarly, members of the state military forces under government code 437.223 are exempt from arrest when they are en route to or from active duty.
Okay, so does that mean they just can't be arrested for anything during those privileged times? That sounds like a pretty broad immunity, like a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Ah, but that's the crucial exception, and it's a big one. These privileges do not extend to cases of treason, felony, or breach of the peace.
Treason, felony, or breach of the peace. Okay, treason and felony are clear. What counts as breach of the peace in this context?
Breach of the peace generally refers to actions that disturb public order or incite violence. It's usually considered something more serious than, say, a minor traffic offense or maybe jaywalking. Think more like disorderly conduct involving fighting or maybe public intoxication leading to disturbances.
Okay, so let's take an example. An officer stops a man who's, I don't know, wearing a suit, maybe speeding, and finds out there's a warrant for unpaid traffic tickets. The man says, "Hold on, I'm a member of the Texas Congress. I'm heading to Austin right now for the legislative session. It opens in 3 days, and I live 80 miles away." What should the officer do?
Okay, applying the rules. He lives 80 miles away, which gives him 4 days of travel privilege. 20 miles a day equals 4 days. The session starts in 3 days, so he's well within that travel window. Assuming the traffic warrant isn't for treason, a felony, or a serious breach of the peace, which unpaid tickets generally aren't, then yes, he is privileged from arrest at that moment.
So the officer just lets him go.
The officer typically wouldn't make the physical arrest on the warrant. They would likely verify his status, note the privilege applies, and probably issue him a citation or a notice to appear regarding the warrant, rather than taking him into custody right then. However, if that same legislator had just, say, committed an assault or was found driving drunk, or was involved in some other felony,
then the privilege wouldn't apply.
Exactly. The privilege is intended to protect the legislative function, making sure members can get to and from session without being unduly harassed or detained for minor issues. It's not a blanket immunity from consequences for actual criminal behavior.
Got it. Okay, so setting aside those special privileges, once an officer does decide to make a lawful arrest on anyone else, what are the step-by-step procedures? They can't just, tackle someone. There must be very specific protocols for safety and legality.
Indeed. There are very specific and well-established procedures, and they're largely driven by two main concerns: officer safety and legal compliance. The very first step is making the arrest clear.
Clarity. How so?
It's vital for the officer to advise the subject clearly using plain language, something like, "You are under arrest for," and then state the reason. This verbal clarity is crucial because, as the source material points out, sometimes subjects resist simply because they genuinely don't understand why they're being arrested. Confusion can lead to resistance.
That makes sense. Tell people what's happening.
Exactly. And even before applying handcuffs, officers are often trained to perform what's called a compliance touch check.
Compliance touch check? What's that?
It's usually a quick initial physical contact, maybe gently guiding an arm used as a method for the officer to gain some initial control and, importantly, to gauge the suspect's potential for resistance or unexpected movement before fully committing to applying the cuffs. It's a way to sort of test the waters and ensure initial control.
Okay. And then the handcuffing itself.
Right. Then they focus on gaining control of the hands, loading the cuffs properly, and applying them in the standard manner.
And this leads to that critical sequence I think I've heard about, where the order of operations for handcuffing and searching is absolutely paramount for safety.
Yes, absolutely paramount. The universal rule drilled into officers for safety and procedural correctness is handcuff, then search.
Handcuff first, then search. Always.
Always, unless there are extreme exigent circumstances. You secure the individual first by handcuffing them, then you conduct the physical search for weapons or contraband. This sequence minimizes the risk to the officer by ensuring the individual is restrained before the officer starts putting their hands into potentially dangerous areas like pockets or waistbands.
Okay, that makes total sense. Let's talk more about the handcuffing techniques and considerations. It sounds like there's more to it than just slapping on the cuffs, especially when you consider the potential for injury and, as we'll see, serious legal repercussions.
Absolutely. It's a skill that requires training and care. Officers are trained in various standard handcuffing positions. They might have the person standing, kneeling, or even prone, face down on the ground, depending on the situation and the perceived risk.
And how should the cuffs be applied?
For a single suspect, the ideal technique generally involves placing their hands behind their back with the palms facing outwards. And then, critically, the handcuffs must be double locked.
Double locked. What does that mean?
Most modern handcuffs have a mechanism, usually a small pin or lever, that you engage after the cuffs are on. This prevents the ratchet part of the cuff from tightening further. It's a safety feature to stop the cuffs from getting too tight accidentally during movement or a struggle. And after double locking, the officer should also check the tightness, making sure they're secure but not cutting off circulation, but only when it is safe to do so. Obviously, in the middle of a struggle, safety takes priority, but proper application should follow as soon as possible.
Are there exceptions, like in an emergency?
Yes, absolutely. Hmm. In a true emergency situation, the priority is gaining control. Handcuffs might be applied quickly in any manner possible, maybe even in front, just to stop an immediate threat. Proper technique and double locking should follow once the situation is stabilized.
You mentioned legal repercussions. This is where it gets really interesting, or perhaps worrying. The source mentions cases involving improper handcuffing leading to massive lawsuits. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, this is a significant area of liability for officers and departments. Officers can be, and have been, found liable for using excessive force simply due to unduly tightening handcuffs, especially if the person complains of pain or has a pre-existing condition. This can lead to nerve damage, circulation problems, or just extreme unnecessary pain.
And the courts have backed this up.
Oh, yes. The legal cases cited are quite clear. For example, in Vondrak v. City of Las Cruces, officers were denied qualified immunity. That's the legal protection that often shields government officials from lawsuits, specifically because they had unduly tightened an arrestee's handcuffs.
So even immunity didn't protect them there?
Correct. Similarly, Baskin v. Smith highlighted that tight handcuffing and the failure to double lock the cuffs can absolutely lead to valid excessive force claims, particularly if the suspect complains about the tightness or has a known medical condition that could be aggravated.
And then there's the Goose case.
Yeah.
That sounds particularly extreme.
It is perhaps the most striking example mentioned. In Goose v. City of Los Angeles, a surgeon was awarded an absolutely astounding $33 million in damages.
$33 million for handcuffing?
Yes, because the jury found that excessively tight handcuffing caused permanent nerve damage to his hand, leaving him unable to perform surgery unassisted for the rest of his career.
Wow. It underscores how even a seemingly routine procedure like handcuffing, if done improperly, can have profound life-altering consequences and massive legal and financial costs.
Absolutely. It really highlights the severe lasting consequences of improper application and reinforces why proper training, technique, double locking, and checking for tightness are so incredibly important for the safety and rights of the person being arrested and for the legal protection of the officer in the department.
Okay, that's a huge point. What about handcuffing multiple suspects? Are there different techniques if you have, say, two people in limited cuffs?
Yes, there are techniques for handling multiple suspects to maintain control. If an officer has two suspects but only one set of handcuffs, the standard training is often to cuff them right hand or left hand to left hand.
Way like that.
It makes it incredibly difficult for them to coordinate movement or run effectively if they're essentially tethered side by side.
Clever. And if you have two suspects and two sets of cuffs,
then the more secure method is typically taught. Have both suspects place their hands behind their backs, interlock their arms slightly, palms out, apply the cuffs with the keyholes facing up for easier removal later, and of course, double lock both sets. It's all about maximizing control and officer safety in a potentially more complex situation.
Are there alternatives to standard handcuffs?
In an emergency, yes. Officers might use things like zip ties, flex cuffs, belts, shoelaces, even strips of cloth as temporary restraining devices if standard cuffs aren't available. But it's important to remember that handcuffs, even standard metal ones, are fundamentally designed as a temporary restraining device, not for long-term confinement.
Okay, so the suspect is now properly handcuffed and double locked. The next critical step for officer safety is the searching procedure. Are there specific safety protocols before the officer even starts the physical search?
Absolutely, and it often starts with what officers sometimes informally call the magic question.
The magic question, what is it?
Before beginning the physical search, the officer should ask something direct like, before I search you, do you have any weapons, needles, knives, or anything on you that can poke or cut me?
Why ask that? Won't people just lie?
Some might lie, yes. But asking serves several purposes. Firstly, it's an essential safety inquiry for the officer. It puts the suspect on notice and might prevent the officer from getting stuck by a hidden needle or cut by a concealed razor blade. Secondly, sometimes people will actually tell the truth, perhaps to avoid additional charges or injury. Eliciting that information verbally first is a key safety step.
Okay, makes sense. And for the search itself, are there standard positions?
Yes. Similar to handcuffing, officers are trained in various search positions, often mirroring the handcuffing ones. A standing body search, a kneeling body search, a prone body search, searching someone while they're face down, and also the standing body wall search, where the suspect leans against a wall. Though the source notes the wall search is considered a higher risk technique, and officers should consult their specific department policy on its use.
And what's the methodology for the actual search? Where do they start and how do they do it systematically?
It needs to be very systematic to be effective and safe. The most critical instruction, according to the source, is to always start the search at the back waistband.
The back waistband first. Why there?
It's identified as a very common area for concealing weapons, like handguns. Starting there allows the officer to immediately check and clear perhaps the highest risk area, and it also keeps the officer positioned behind the suspect, maintaining a position of advantage and control if resistance suddenly occurs.
Okay, and after the waistband?
From there, officers are trained to slowly and methodically search each designated zone of the body. The body is typically divided into maybe 6 zones for this purpose. The waistband area, the upper right quadrant, lower right leg foot, upper left quadrant, lower left leg foot, and finally, the head hair area.
And the technique of searching, is it just patting them down?
No, and this is vital. Officers are explicitly taught no patting with the flat palm of the hand.
No padding? Why not?
Padding with the palm can easily miss smaller or flatter objects, like a razor blade taped to the skin or a small baggie of drugs. Instead, they should use a more probing technique, often described as using the bladed edge of the hand or careful manipulation with the fingers, especially for sensitive areas, to feel for objects through the clothing. This allows for a more thorough search while still being appropriate.
And where should the officer be looking while doing this?
Critically, the officer's eyes should remain on the subject during the search, watching their hands, face, and body for any signs of movement, tension, or attempt to resist or conceal something further. The hands do the searching, but the eyes maintain situational awareness.
Okay, so it's a very controlled, methodical process. Where are the most common places officers are trained to look for concealed items beyond the waistband?
Officers need to be aware of and check a wide range of common concealment places. These include obvious places like pockets and linings in clothing, but also things like belts. Sometimes items are hidden inside buckle compartments, shoes, socks, other footwear like inside boots, hats or other headwear, inside jewelry, within bags or purses they might be carrying, sometimes hidden in hair, especially long or braided hair, under the arms, and even items taped directly to the body. Being thorough and checking all these potential spots is paramount for safety and for finding any contraband or evidence.
Right. After the handcuffing and the thorough search, the suspect needs to be escorted and transported, presumably to a police station or jail. What are the proper procedures here, again, focusing on safety?
The number one rule is that suspects must remain handcuffed at all times during both the escort, walking them, and the transport, driving them, always in adherence to agency policy.
Okay, always cuffed. How should officers position themselves when escorting?
The recommended positions depend on the number of officers and suspects, always aiming for control and safety. If it's one officer escorting one suspect, the officer should typically position themselves slightly to the rear and side of the suspect, making sure the officer's own firearm side is away from the suspect.
Gun side away. Makes sense. What about two officers?
If there are two officers escorting one suspect, they might position themselves one on either side or both slightly behind. If it's one officer with two suspects, which is less ideal but can happen, the officer should stay to the rear of both. And for two officers with two suspects, they might walk behind them or have one officer positioned on the outer side of each suspect.
Is there anything officers should avoid doing when escorting?
Yes, a crucial caution mentioned is do not hold on to the handcuffs themselves, like grabbing the chain between the cuffed hands.
Why not? Seems like a way to hold on.
Because it gives the suspect significant leverage. They could potentially twist or pull in a way that compromises the officer's balance or control, making it much more dangerous. Officers should maintain control by guiding the suspect's arm, not by holding the cuffs directly.
Good point. Okay, now for transport in a vehicle. What if the patrol car doesn't have a cage or partition between the front and back seats? That can happen with certain types of police vehicles or older models. What are the seating arrangements then?
Right. If there's no cage, specific seating arrangements are recommended to maximize safety and maintain observation. For one officer transporting one suspect, the suspect usually sits in the right front seat.
In the front, really?
Yes. Without a cage, it allows the lone officer driving to better observe and potentially react if the suspect tries something, compared to having them directly behind where they can't be seen easily. For two officers transporting one suspect, the suspect sits in the right rear seat, with the second officer sitting directly behind the driver in the left rear seat, allowing that officer to directly monitor the suspect.
Okay. And if there are two suspects?
If it's two officers transporting two suspects without a cage, the suspects typically sit together in the rear seat, perhaps right rear and center, with the second officer again in the left rear seat to supervise both.
And seatbelts?
Absolutely. In all these scenarios, all transported suspects must be properly seatbelted, and the vehicle doors should be locked to prevent escapes.
And what happens after the transport? Is there a final safety step?
Yes, a vital one. Officers must search the seating or carrying area of their vehicle, whether it's the back seat or wherever the prisoner was, after each prisoner transport is completed.
Why is that so important?
To check for any weapons or contraband the prisoner might have ditched, hidden, or dropped during the transport. This prevents a subsequent arrestee, or even the officer later, from finding a discarded weapon, drugs, or other dangerous items. It ensures the safety of future occupants and maintains the integrity and security of the patrol vehicle. It's a critical final check.
Okay, we've built a really robust understanding now of the legal definitions, the related offenses, the procedures. Let's try to connect all these insights to some real-world, maybe more complex situations. Pulling directly from our source material again, let's see how these rules actually apply when things get dynamic and the lines might seem blurry.
Yeah, this definitely raises that important question. How do officers actually apply these detailed legal rules and procedures when they're under pressure, maybe in ambiguous situations? And how can these scenarios help illuminate those really fine lines we talked about, the difference between just a consensual chat, a temporary detention, and a full-blown arrest? Because, as you say, they are not always as clear-cut in the real world as they might appear in training manual. Understanding the implications is crucial.
Okay, let's start with the James scenario. Race, suspicion, detention, and search. Here's the setup. It's 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. James, who is an African-American teenager, is walking through a predominantly Caucasian neighborhood where there have been some recent daytime burglaries. Families are out. It's a normal Saturday. Officer Jones is on patrol and observes James walking. First question, is there enough reasonable suspicion for Officer Jones to even make contact based only on James's race, his presence in that neighborhood, and the fact that there have been recent burglaries nearby?
Based only on those factors you listed, almost certainly no. Reasonable suspicion, remember, requires specific, articulable facts that lead a reasonable officer to infer that that particular person is involved in criminal activity.
Right. Specific facts about him.
Exactly. Race alone is never sufficient. Being present in a particular neighborhood, even one that has experienced recent crime, is also generally not enough by itself. There needs to be something more concrete, something about James's specific behavior or appearance that links him directly to the suspected criminal activity beyond just his demographics or location. Without that, just stopping him based on race and location would be profiling, which is unconstitutional.
Okay, so no reasonable suspicion initially. Then Officer Jones stops his car, gets out, and calls out to James, "Hey, I need to talk to you for a few minutes." How would you categorize this initial contact? Is it consensual, a detention, meaning restraint, or maybe even an arrest at this point?
At this very initial stage, it could potentially be argued that it's intended as a consensual encounter. An officer is allowed to approach anyone in a public place and ask them questions, and theoretically, a reasonable person in James's position might feel free to decline the conversation and just walk away.
Might. But maybe not.
Exactly. It heavily depends on the officer's tone of voice, their body language, whether the patrol car lights were activated, things like that. If Officer Jones's approach or his statement, "I need to talk to you," reasonably conveyed a sense of command rather than a simple request.
Yeah, need sounds demanding.
It does. If James reasonably felt, under the totality of those circumstances, that he wasn't actually free to leave, then it could immediately shift from being a consensual encounter to being a non-consensual detention or seizure under the Fourth Amendment right from that first interaction. The key is always how a reasonable person in the subject's shoes would perceive the situation.
Okay, so the officer then asks, "What are you doing out here?" James politely explains he's walking to a friend's house nearby to work on a science project. James then asks the officer why he was stopped, and he starts to walk away slowly. The scenario says Officer Jones appears agitated and physically blocks James's path. Now what? What's the nature of the contact at this point, and is blocking his path legal?
Okay. At this point, the nature of the contact has definitively shifted. Any ambiguity about it being consensual is gone. When Officer Jones physically blocks James's path, preventing him from walking away, that is a clear assertion of authority and physical restraint. It unequivocally transforms the encounter into a detention, a seizure under the Fourth Amendment.
And is that detention legal?
For this detention to be legal, Officer Jones would need to have developed reasonable suspicion that James was involved in criminal activity before he blocked James's path. Based on the facts given so far, James walking, explaining his purpose politely, it doesn't sound like any new facts supporting reasonable suspicion have emerged. Unless James did something else suspicious, simply being agitated because James asked why he was stopped and started to leave likely wouldn't be enough. So, blocking his path at this point without more articulable suspicion would probably make the detention unlawful. This is exactly where an interaction based on flimsy grounds can cross that legal line.
Okay, so likely an unlawful detention now. What happens next in the scenario? The officer then, without asking, removes the backpack James is wearing, opens it up, and searches through it. He tells James he's checking it for weapons. Inside, the officer only finds science books and manuals. Is this search legal?
Almost certainly not. This search would very likely be illegal. Remember our discussion about searches. A limited frisk or pat-down of someone's outer clothing is permitted during a lawful detention, only if the officer has reasonable suspicion that the person is armed and dangerous.
Right. Outer clothing for weapons only.
Exactly. A full search of the contents of someone's backpack goes way beyond the scope of a protective frisk. Searching inside the backpack requires a higher level of justification. The officer would typically need probable cause to believe the backpack contained evidence of a crime, or consent from James to search it, or search warrant.
None of which seem present here.
Correct. He didn't find weapons during a frisk. He didn't even seem to conduct one. And finding science books certainly doesn't provide probable cause for burglary. Without reasonable suspicion James was armed and that a weapon would be in the backpack, or probable cause related to the burglaries linked to the backpack's contents, this search appears to be unconstitutional, a violation of James's Fourth Amendment rights.
Okay. And finally, after finding nothing, the officer gives the backpack back and says, "There's been a number of burglaries in the area. Now get out of here before I arrest you." What does that final statement reveal about how this whole interaction should be viewed legally?
That concluding statement is quite revealing. It strongly reinforces the fact that James was not free to leave throughout most of this encounter, certainly not once the officer blocked his path and searched his bag. The officer's explicit threat of arrest, "Before I arrest you," confirms that James was being detained, likely unlawfully given the lack of reasonable suspicion or probable cause. This entire scenario serves as a powerful practical lesson. It shows how quickly interactions, perhaps started on shaky ground like potential profiling, can escalate into unlawful detentions and searches when officers act without the necessary legal justification. For you, the listener, it really underscores the importance of understanding the difference between a consensual conversation you can walk away from and a detention where your rights against unreasonable searches and seizures are fully engaged.
Very clear illustration. Okay, let's go to the next scenario. The gas station beer run. Traffic stop legality and detention versus arrest. Here's the setup. An officer is watching a gas station convenience store that's known in the area for frequent beer runs, thefts of beer. The officer sees a male run quickly from the store carrying two large 30 packs of beer. The male jumps into a nearby car and immediately drives off. The officer notes the car didn't commit any traffic offenses like speeding or running a stop sign. The officer follows and stops the car about two blocks away. First question, is this traffic stop legal, even though no traffic offense was committed?
Yes, in this instance, the traffic stop is legal. While it's true the driver didn't commit a traffic violation that the officer saw, the officer observed other behavior that created reasonable suspicion of a different crime.
The beer run itself.
Exactly. The officer saw the male running from a store known for beer thefts, carrying a large quantity of beer, and then quickly getting into a car and leaving. Taken together, these specific, articulable facts create a reasonable suspicion that a crime, specifically theft, has just occurred. And reasonable suspicion of any criminal activity, not just traffic offenses, can legally justify a temporary investigatory stop of a vehicle. So the stop itself is likely justified.
Okay, so the stop is legal based on suspected theft. Now let's look at the nature of the contact after the stop. The driver tells the officer he did buy the beer, but says he lost the receipt. The officer says, well, I need to verify this by taking you back to the gas station. The driver objects, say he doesn't want to go back. The officer then advises him, look, if you're telling the truth, I'll bring you right back and let you go, and then has the driver get out and sit unhandcuffed in the back seat of the patrol car. The officer drives back to the station, verifies with the clerk that no theft occurred, brings the driver back to his car, and releases him. Now, how do we classify this interaction? Was it consensual, a detention, or an arrest?
This contact was clearly, at minimum, a detention, and it very likely crossed the line into what could be considered a constructive custody situation, maybe even a de facto arrest, the moment the driver was placed in the back of the patrol car against his will.
Even though he wasn't handcuffed?
Yes. Being placed in the confined space of the back of a police vehicle, especially after you've explicitly objected to going somewhere, would make any reasonable person feel that they are not free to leave. That's the definition of being seized or detained. The officer's statement, I need to verify this by taking you to the gas station, wasn't a request. It was presented as a requirement, a clear assertion of control.
So not consensual, more than just a brief stop.
Definitely not consensual at that point. While he wasn't formally called, you're under arrest, and wasn't handcuffed, the level of restraint on his liberty being transported against his will in a police car was significant. This prolonged detention, essentially moving him from the scene, would require ongoing reasonable suspicion, and arguably might have needed probable cause for arrest to be fully justified, depending on the specific jurisdiction's interpretation of when a detention becomes an arrest.
Okay, so it was definitely a detention, possibly bordering on arrest. Given what we've learned about legal limits and best practices, how could or should the officer perhaps have handled this situation differently to ensure legality and maybe avoid escalating it quite so far?
That's a great question about best practices. The officer initially had valid, reasonable suspicion to make the stop. That part was fine. However, instead of immediately insisting on taking the driver back to the store and placing him in the patrol car, especially after the driver objected, there might have been less intrusive alternatives.
Like what?
Well, the officer could have first tried simply asking for the driver's consent to return to the gas station to verify the purchase. Would you mind if we drove back quickly so I can confirm with the clerk? If the driver consented, then it's fine.
And if he refused consent?
If consent was denied, the officer would then need to assess if the facts they had running from the store, no receipt, rose to the level of probable cause for theft. If it did, they could make a formal arrest and then transport him. But if it was still just reasonable suspicion, not quite probable cause, forcibly transporting him back might be problematic.
So what else could they have done if they only had suspicion?
Other less intrusive options could include the officer offering to call the gas station from the roadside on their phone or radio to try and verify the purchase that way. Or perhaps the officer could have asked the driver to wait briefly while the officer drove back to the station to check, allowing the driver to remain with his own vehicle. The key principle is always to use the least intrusive means necessary to confirm or dispel suspicion during a temporary detention. Escalating directly to involuntary transport in a police car without probable cause or consent pushes the legal boundaries.
Right. Find ways to investigate without significantly increasing the restraint on the person, if possible. Okay, next scenario. The intoxicated driver at home. An officer observes a car weaving significantly on the road, clearly suggesting impairment. The officer decides to stop the car, but has to turn around. By the time the officer makes the U-turn and gets back, the weaving car has already pulled into a residential driveway. As the officer pulls up, the male driver has already parked the car, gotten out, and is now physically on the front porch of the house, fumbling with keys, trying to open the front door. The officer contacts him there on the porch and observes he's obviously very intoxicated. What can or should the officer do now with the male subject? And what about his car? Justify the answers.
Okay, this is a classic and often quite complex scenario that really highlights the legal distinctions between the offense of DWI, driving while intoxicated, and other intoxication-related offenses. The absolute key fact here is that the officer did not observe the male operating or driving the vehicle at the precise moment of contact on the porch.
Right, the driving had stopped just before the officer got there.
Exactly. The officer did observe the weaving earlier, which provides excellent probable cause to believe that a DWI offense did occur just moments before. That observation certainly justifies investigating further. However, since the individual is no longer in actual physical control of the vehicle when the officer makes contact with him on the porch, it might complicate making a direct DWI arrest at that exact moment. Some elements of DWI require operation of the vehicle.
So if maybe not DWI right then and there, what are the officer's options for dealing with the clearly intoxicated individual on the porch? Can they still arrest him for something?
Yes. The officer's options shift focus. The male is on his front porch. Now, whether a front porch counts as a public place can vary slightly by jurisdiction, but often, if it's visible and accessible from the street, it can be considered public for the purpose of certain laws. His obvious intoxication, especially if he appears to be a danger to himself or others, maybe he's unstable on his feet, unable to care for himself, belligerent, could lead to a lawful arrest for public intoxication.
Public intoxication instead of DWI.
Potentially, yes. This is a very common charge in situations like this, where someone is clearly intoxicated in a public or quasi-public place, but isn't caught actively driving at that exact moment. The officer would need to be able to articulate why the person's intoxication posed a danger, not just that they were drunk.
Okay. And what about the car left sitting in the driveway? Can the officer have it impounded or towed?
Regarding the car, since the driver is no longer in control of it and is likely going to be arrested for public intoxication or perhaps DWI if further investigation supports it, the car shouldn't just be left unsecured in the driveway. Now, can it be impounded as evidence of DWI? Probably not directly, since the driving wasn't observed at the moment of contact. However, it could potentially be legally towed under the community caretaking doctrine.
Community caretaking, what's that?
It's a legal principle that allows police to take actions, like securing a vehicle, to protect property and prevent public safety hazards, even if it's not strictly part of a criminal investigation. So if the car is blocking something, or if leaving it there unsecured poses a risk of theft or vandalism, especially if the arrested owner can't arrange for someone else to get it, towing it to a secure location might be justified for community caretaking. Also, if the person is arrested, department policy often allows for an inventory search of the vehicle prior to it being towed or secured, mainly to document valuables and protect the police from liability, though sometimes evidence is found during these. The officer should certainly try to ensure the vehicle is secured somehow, either by towing or releasing it to another responsible, sober, licensed driver designated by the owner if one is available.
Got it. Okay, final scenario. Meth in plain view. An officer is doing a routine foot patrol around 3 a.m. through a motel parking lot. The officer walks past a parked Toyota Prius and happens to spot, sitting in plain view on the center console inside the car, a small baggie containing a white crystalline substance the officer recognizes, based on training and experience, as likely being methamphetamine. The car is locked, and the officer's attempts to locate the owner or renter of the car fail. What can or should the officer do in this situation? Explain and justify the answer.
Okay, this situation falls squarely under the legal doctrine known as plain view.
Plain view. How does that work?
The plain view doctrine says that if an officer is lawfully present in a location where they have a right to be, like a public motel parking lot.
Which they are here.
Right. And from that lawful vantage point, they observe an item and the item's incriminating nature is immediately apparent.
Meaning they instantly recognize it as illegal?
Exactly. They have probable cause to believe it's contraband or evidence of a crime just by looking at it. If those conditions are met, the officer can seize that item without needing a search warrant first. In this case, the officer is lawfully in the parking lot. The baggie of suspected meth is clearly visible through the car window in plain view. And based on training, its nature as likely contraband is immediately apparent. So the officer does have the right to seize that methamphetamine.
Okay, they have the right to seize it. But you mentioned the car is locked, and they can't find the owner. Does that complicate the actual seizure? Can the officer just break the window or unlock the door to get the meth?
Ah, that's the practical challenge. While the plain view doctrine gives the officer probable cause and the legal right to seize the item, it doesn't automatically grant them the right to make a warrantless entry into a protected space, like a locked car, to retrieve it.
So seeing it doesn't automatically mean they can go in after it without a warrant.
Not automatically, no. To physically reach inside that locked Prius to retrieve the baggie, the officer would typically need one of three things. A search warrant specifically for the car, the owner's consent, which they can't get here, or what are called exigent circumstances.
Exigent circumstances, like an emergency.
Yes, like if there was an immediate danger that the evidence would be destroyed or removed if the officer took the time to get a warrant. In this scenario, 3 a.m., parked car, owner nowhere to be found, it's unlikely that immediate destruction of the meth is a pressing concern.
So no obvious emergency. What's the best practice then?
The best practice and the most legally sound approach would likely be for the officer to secure the vehicle first. This might mean simply keeping an eye on it, or perhaps having it towed to a secure police impound lot where it can't be driven away or accessed by others. Then, using the probable cause established by the plain view observation, the officer seeing the meth, they should obtain a search warrant for the vehicle from a judge.
Get the warrant based on what they saw.
Exactly. Once the warrant is signed, they can then lawfully enter the locked vehicle and seize the methamphetamine as evidence. So the plain view doctrine provides the probable cause needed for the warrant and the eventual seizure, but generally not an automatic right to break into a locked car unless those specific exceptions like exigent circumstances clearly apply. Securing it and getting a warrant is usually the safer route.
Wow. Okay. What a deep dive that was. We've really unpacked so much today. Everything from those four essential conditions for a lawful arrest to the really nuanced definitions of restraint and custody. And we explored that whole wide array of related offenses like resisting, evading, hindering, even things like contraband in jails.
Mm-hmm.
We even walked through the very detailed step-by-step procedures for things like handcuffing and the serious consequences if that's done wrong and searching. And applying all those rules to these real-world scenarios really brought it home. It seems crystal clear that knowing these distinctions isn't just something for lawyers or police officers. It feels pretty fundamental for every citizen to understand their rights and also their responsibilities in these situations.
Absolutely. And if we really connect this to the bigger picture, this deep dive truly highlights the incredible complexity that can exist within seemingly simple interactions with law enforcement. Nothing is quite as straightforward as it might appear on TV.
Definitely not.
And it really raises an important question, I think, for you, the listener, to consider personally. How might your own gut-level understanding, your personal feeling of what constitutes restraint or custody, influence how you might react in a real-life encounter with an officer? And maybe more importantly, how crucial is it to actually understand the precise legal definitions before reacting, especially given that striking fact we covered, that even resisting what you believe is an unlawful arrest is still itself an offense. The law really does place a high value on orderly process, even when things feel unjust in the moment.
That is a truly thought-provoking question to leave us with, something to really mull over. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening deep dive. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and stay well informed.